on the road again. Just can't wait to get on the road again. The life I love is making.
Oh, we're going to get on the road again with another edition of On Your Money with the Memorial Day weekend approaching and the summer travel season just about upon us. Kevin McKinley will have some advice on saving on transportation costs and saving money at the gas pump during this edition of On Your Money. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We will also have room for your personal finance questions, whatever they may be, at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Kevin McKinley is a certified financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money LLC, and he joins us from our studios in Eau Claire. Hello, Kevin.
Hello, Joy.
So are you going to be on the road again for Memorial Day?
Absolutely not. I am a contrarian by nature, and so this is the kind of weekend where our people, we stay home and stay off the roads, and we'll travel another time.
Yeah. Well, Memorial Day does mean the beginning of more driving and travel for most of us. And over the summer, we're going to be talking about the many ways that we can spend less on transportation costs. Where are we going to start today, Kevin?
Well, among those things, we're going to have a special segment every week called Car Conversation, just because we think it's time that public radio is used as a medium to discuss car problems. It's never been done before that I know of. And so I think you and I are the people to do that.
I'm going to brush up on that laugh.
I wish you would. We're going to start with our driving, the cars, the miles, the future of our driving. Some things remain the same, but some things are changing, and there could be some much bigger consequences because of these very small incremental changes.
Well, let's start with our cars. How long are we keeping cars?
In Wisconsin, one of the reasons I love living in this state, one of the reasons I love being on Wisconsin Public Radio, because listeners are even more so, we do not brag about how new our cars are. We brag about what is on the odometer. And according to Polk, we are part of a trend. New cars are now being kept by the original owner 71.6 months on average. That's almost 6 years.
Wow.
And used cars, when a person purchases a used car, he or she keeps the vehicle for 50.7 months on average. That's over 4 years. The median vehicle age on the road right now is the highest it's ever been, 11 years. That means if you have a vehicle that's newer than a 2003 model, you are in the upper half of new cars versus old cars. That figure 11 years ago was 9 years compared to the 11 years median age right now. And that probably would be higher except for the Cash for Clunkers program we had a few years ago, which took a lot of old, inefficient but running cars off of the road. And the reasons for this, of course, are the vehicles are better, and we also have more frugal buyers who don't see the need to jump into a new vehicle every 2 or 3 years. And there haven't been any huge technological advances in the vehicles which would cause people to do that, other than maybe more fuel efficient or some hybrids, which we'll be talking about later on.
So how many miles are we putting on our cars?
That's the figure that is dropping for the eighth year in a row, both total overall miles driven and average miles driven. Right now, the average American driver puts about 9,300 miles on for 2012. That's down from over 10,000 in 2005. Reasons a little bit having to do with gas prices and the cost of driving, but more economic. The average miles driven and miles driven have gone up and down directly in correlation with the workforce participation rate, meaning that a lot of older drivers have retired and don't feel the need to still, you know, get up at 7:30 in the morning and spend an hour in traffic. And then younger drivers not only are less likely to be employed than they were 4 or 5 years ago, but they're also are less likely to take the car and drive down to the McDonald's parking lot and sit there on a Saturday night and then cruise up and down. They're more likely to socialize on Facebook, which doesn't necessarily require you to get in your car. The interesting thing about this from a broader standpoint is that many states tax a flat cent rate on gas, and that's a big revenue driver for departments of transportation, et cetera. Wisconsin's is 30.9 cents per gallon, plus another 2 cents for a special fund. That's 14th highest in the country. New York's is highest at 50 cents or so, and Alaska's is lower than 8 cents. But as less people drive miles, so does that revenue go down, and so many different states are looking for different ways to keep the revenue up that they need to support the projects and the maintenance, et cetera, that they've been performing for the last century or so.
Yeah, lots of budget issues involved there. And we also have budget issues with gas prices these days. We'll talk a little bit later in the show about saving money at the gas pump.
Correct.
All right. I'm Joy Cardine talking with Kevin McKinley. He is the managing member of McKinley Money, LLC, a registered investment advisor with offices in Eau Claire and Madison. Kevin does not intend to provide personalized investment advice through this broadcast and does not represent that the securities or services discussed are suitable for any investor. Investors should consult with their personal finance advisors prior to making any investment decisions. That being said, if you have a question for Kevin, 1-800-642-1234 is the number to call, 1-800-642-1234. You can also send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. And it's time now for the On Your Money email bag. And Kevin, we are still getting questions on our series on housing and home ownership. And we've received a couple of emails regarding how to decide if a buyer should pay more for the right place or just walk away. So when do you pony up more and when do you walk away?
When Kenny Rogers had the great philosopher asked that same question at one point. It's a tough question. And part of the problem is exacerbated by the fact that supply of homes for sale is still way down from what it was 3 or 4 years ago, and especially a year or two ago, and for lots of different reasons. But it means that finding just the right place is more difficult now than ever. And a lot of people run into a problem, especially responsible ones, who say, hey, we're going to cap our expenditure here. We're only going to spend so much on it. And they run into this great place, but the price is higher than what they're looking to spend. And if they would just take a second, they would find out and figure out that it may be more affordable than they think. And because of that limited market, it might be better off to push themselves a little bit more to get just the right place.
How so?
Well, let's say someone's considering the perfect $220,000 house, but they only want to spend $200,000. If they were, like most people, paying 20% for the down payment and getting a 30-year fixed-rate mortgage, in reality, they'd only have to spend about $4,000 more for the down payment to get the 20% level of the higher price, and their new mortgage payment would be $100 per month. Now, that can definitely be a significant expenditure, especially if you're right up against your budget to begin with. But if you were to find a less than perfect house, you may end up spending more than that down payment amount and monthly payment amount to improve it to the way that you want it. And something as good as the one that you're looking at may not even exist as a property for sale in any amount of time.
So, Kevin, do you agree with those who say you should buy as much house as you can afford?
No, much to the chagrin of some realtors and lenders, I think that people should try to stick to a home that is roughly 2 to 3 times their annual income, meaning if you have an income of, let's say, $50,000 for your household, you shouldn't go over $150,000 in most cases for the purchase price of your house. And I do also think you should be able to put 20% down and get a 30-year mortgage. And the key goal here is to try to find a place in which you'll have to, you can avoid moving for as long as possible, meaning it will last you for the foreseeable future. So if you have to stick your neck out a little bit to get that place, it's in a better school district, extra bedroom, closer to work, whatever you're looking for, it's better to do that rather than try to buy something and hoping you're going to make some mythical profit on it down the road.
Coming up on this edition of On Your Money, Kevin will have some advice on withdrawing money from a college savings plan, and plus some tips on saving gas money. And we have room for you if you have a personal finance question for Kevin at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. And our first caller for Kevin is Bob in Menominee. Hello, Bob. You're on the air.
Hi, Kevin. I certainly appreciate the sound advice that you give on your program.
And thank you, Bob.
The question I have a CD that's expired, and are you still recommending CDs as for preserving capital in view of the low rates, or is there something better? And I would like to get your opinion on the better of two CDs with the different terms.
Okay. What are the CDs first?
The CD is 1.5% with a 6-month penalty versus 1.9% with a 12-month penalty.
And what are the terms of the CDs? How long are they out to maturity?
Oh, I'm sorry. We're talking 5 years here.
For both of them?
Yeah.
Okay. Sadly, I think I actually even know which CDs of that you're speaking of because it's so hard to find safe investments that pay a decent yield right now. And for that reason, especially when you're talking about preserving capital, CDs still are probably the best bet out there. Offhand, if you plan on using it and the money sooner than that, I'd, of course, have you go with the one with a lesser penalty. But otherwise, if you see yourself keeping that money in there for as long as possible, I'd much rather have you go with the highest interest rate one. And if you're going to use CDs, I do recommend you do what you're doing, Bob, is that you try to go out as long as you can stand it, but then pay very close attention to that so-called substantial penalty for early withdrawal, because that can be as little as 6 months, or it can be a year, or it can be more. Some institutions are putting in what's known as a market-based penalty, and that means that if you leave the money in for the stated term, you'll get it back plus the interest. But if you pull it out early, the institution will tell you at that time how much you can get out. And if interest rates have risen, there's a good chance you'll get out quite a bit less than what you planned. So you have to be very cautious about that. One other alternative that is also very safe and does pay something approaching a yield is those Series I savings bonds that we've mentioned before. And you can find those at treasurydirect.gov. Those pay an interest rate that fluctuates, and it's set every May 1st and November 1st. The new one that came out is a disappointing 1.18%. It is tied to the Consumer Price Index for practical purposes. The good news about that, though, is that you can usually get your money out with only a 3-month penalty of interest after 12 months and no penalty after 5 years. And the better news is the interest is exempt from state taxes. And finally, you can only buy $10,000 per year. You have to buy them online, and it can be kind of a drag to go all the way through the process. But it's a good idea if you have this kind of money coming due to every single year buy those $10,000, and then you start the clock ticking on when you can get the money back out with little or no penalty.
Mm-hmm. This is a considerable amount. More money than the $10,000.
Yeah, it's a good problem to have, but that's one of the reasons that they limit, because it is such an attractive offer. So, yeah, that's something I would take a look at for a smaller portion of money, or if it's something you say, hey, we just want to put a little aside every single year.
All right. Thanks for the call, Bob. Good luck to you. I'm Joy Cardine talking with Kevin McKinley, Certified Financial Planner, Managing Member of McKinley Money, LLC. And if you have a question for Kevin, our number is 1-800-642-1234. What money matter is on your mind today? Or you can send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. This is On Your Money on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
There is nothing quite as wonderful as money. There is nothing quite as beautiful as cash. Some people say it's folly, but I'd rather have the lolly. With money you can make a splash.
This is On Your Money on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine with financial planner Kevin McKinley. And our next caller for Kevin is Warren in Black Earth. Hello, Warren.
Good morning.
Morning.
Thank you for your common sense approach to investing. We appreciate it greatly every week. So,
thank you, Warren.
Our question is, we're considering reallocating our SEP IRA and Roth IRA, my wife and I are, from a currently allocated among various mutual funds, pretty well balanced among managed mutual funds, to a selection of index funds, along the lines that a certain proportion be invested in stock mutual funds, or index funds, I'm sorry, more conservative bond, typically bond mutual funds or index funds, and then some other smaller asset allocations such as foreign index funds or real estate, et cetera, and then rebalancing the percentages every year or twice a year, et cetera. The question is, currently, bond index funds are usually considered to be the conservative part of a portfolio. But with interest rates widely predicted to rise, it doesn't seem to be such a good place to park funds or to have them churning around. I'm wondering if there are other alternatives in terms of index funds or categories that you would think of that would be helpful to fit that more conservative approach.
Kevin, may I jump in just because I think a lot of listeners might be wondering, you know, what exactly is the index fund and some of those terms that we just mentioned.
Yeah, they don't care.
Yeah, they do.
No, they're just people just focus on the road ahead of you, getting your kids off to school or whatever. No, that's a great point because we throw a lot of these terms around, and because it's in my DNA and the caller has an obvious background in it. Index funds are funds that aren't technically managed by somebody. They're kind of a generic fund that buys investments according to a certain pre-established index, and so there's no room for improvement or error by humans being involved for it, and usually because there isn't a lot of work involved in picking out different stocks and bonds, they just buy according to the index, the expenses are low. So I'm generally a very big fan of index funds because I believe in reducing what you can and control for when it comes to investment and financial drag, and internal expenses for mutual funds are one great way to do that. So I definitely applaud the use of index funds. I also applaud Warren's knowledge and trepidation over bond funds because I think if you had to pick one place where the risk may far outweigh the potential reward in the investment world right now, it is in those very same bond funds. I'm not sure interest rates are going to rise. I've been hearing that interest rates are going to rise for 30 years, and so far they haven't. Now, they can't go down very much, and that's part of the problem. I'm not sure how quickly they'll rise from a traditional standpoint. Where they may rise, and this is one of the risks of bond funds, is that the bonds and the issuers of the bonds may have a more difficult time paying off the interest that they've promised to pay, which then drives the price down and the yield up to a new buyer for it. So that's where bond funds can get hurt. And if interest rates do rise in and of themselves in a vacuum, yes, that will also hurt bond funds as well too. So in a SEP plan, it's difficult because you probably have a limited roster of investments you can use. People who do have a exposure to a stable value fund, those aren't perfect and they're not as safe as they're purported to be, but they can offer a more stable place for money that you would otherwise put in a bond fund. Even money market funds are going to have more risk to them going forward than we've had in the past. If it's possible, Warren, look to see if there's a certificate of deposit option within the SEP IRA. Sometimes if it's held at a brokerage firm or something, you can get a brokerage CD. That's probably a better way. Again, you're not going to get very much reward on it, but at least you're going to have a date in mind and when that particular money will come due, and it's FDIC insured, so you've got some safety underneath it as well. And if interest rates do go up, you'll be very glad because the value of the CD may go down, but you will see that it's going to come due at an expected amount at the date in the future.
Okay. Thank you very much. Very helpful.
Thank you.
Thank you, Warren. Our next caller is Carol in Superior. Hello, Carol.
Hi there. I'm calling regarding a Scott's Trade account that we set up for our grandson, probably for educational needs in the future. He's just a year and a half. And we haven't actually invested in anything at this point. We just set up the account, and it'll be something like maybe $1,000 or $2,000 a year, something along those lines. I'm not sure. I'm just wondering what the best way to invest that money might be. My initial thought was maybe 50% in some sort of a utility fund, and then maybe 50% toward some other sort of fund that's a little more aggressive.
Carol, let me have one important question here. Is this grandson of yours, is he gifted and talented?
Of course.
Of course.
Okay, that's what I thought. This is a very important distinction because obviously with that very unbiased opinion of your own grandson, we need to concentrate on making sure he has enough money to pursue his bachelor's and master's and doctorate and probably, I'm guessing, both law school and business school.
You forgot medical school.
Medical school, too, yes. Right, on top of that. Actually, that would be one of the worst wishes I would have for a grandchild. Just keep going to school for the next 45 years of your life. Did you use his Social Security number when you established the account, Carol?
I don't recall. I have to ask my husband that question.
Okay, because
I'm not sure.
Is the grandchild's son's name on the account anywhere or not?
Yes.
Okay, so it's probably a gift to minors account, which is unfortunate for a couple of reasons. One is that It's going to be his money when he turns 18 or 21 or 25, depending on the state. And it also means that you might have a little bit of a tax nightmare that you've thrust upon his parents for the earnings of that particular account. So I would leave that money alone for the time being, and I would try to see if there's some kind of a fund. Like Vanguard has a lot of what are known as lifestyle funds. And rather than try to guess on different allocations and time it, I'd like you to see just like a pick what's known as a lifestyle fund that would probably be 20 years out. And what happens is that's a fund that mixes stock funds, bond funds, and money market funds. And then as the year approaches, let's say it's the 2035 fund, that fund automatically becomes more conservative in the sense that it has less in stocks and more in the bonds and money market. Now, that doesn't guarantee you're not going to lose money. It'll still move up and down in value, but at least the movements probably won't be as dramatic as he's more likely to be using the money coming up. And for future references, what I would do, Sarah, future deposits, Carol, is I would put the money in Wisconsin's Edvest 529 plan, because you get a little tax break on that. You keep total control over it. The earnings stay in there, tax deferred. And if the money's pulled out for qualified higher education expenses, there's no taxes whatsoever. But best of all, he does not get access to the money until you allow him to have access to it. And you can change that at any time. We're going to be talking about that later in the show, in fact. But if you go to edvest.com, that's where I'd rather have you use, especially if you do have it, at least in your mind a little bit, that you're looking more towards higher education expenses.
And can I ask you, if it's not set up in his name, which, again, I'm not sure,
sure,
is there any other different strategy?
Then I would definitely use the Edvest account with that actual money, or another 529 college savings plan. Edvest happens to be Wisconsin's, but you can use any plan you want. But you do, because he's your grandson, putting money in with your grandson as the beneficiary gives you a little tax break on the deposit at your state income tax level.
So for future reference for my gifted and talented nieces and nephews, Kevin, don't open up these accounts with the child's name on it?
There are very few advantages to doing that, especially for someone who is under the age of majority, and teenagers and young adults have been known to behave irresponsibly with money once in a while, and it can create a tax nightmare every single year, and we're actually going to be talking about that in a few weeks. But then it means by law it's the kid's money to do whatever he or she wants with it whenever he or she pleases.
Carol, thank you so much for the call. Tom in Green Bay is with us now. Hello, Tom.
Good morning. I've got a question. I got a daughter that just graduated from Purdue with a chemical engineering degree. She's got a job. She's going to be making around $70,000 a year starting. She's got a ton of debt. I mean, debt ranging from 6% up to 11%. So what I'm looking at is I've got a $300,000 home. I've got about $130,000 left to pay on it. I was wondering if I could refinance it and give her the difference. Draw money out and give her the difference, and then she pays me back or pays the loan back. And would that be the best way to do something like that? So her interest would be locked in at a low rate with no variability.
Yeah, absolutely. And some people, Tom, are throwing up in their mouths right now with the notion of doing this. I actually, if you're comfortable with it, and you know your daughter better than I do, so I'm not going to say you should watch out for it. I'm okay with this, and I think, all the things being equal, I think it's a great idea. You got to be cautious on a couple different things. One is making sure that you don't run afoul of the gift tax laws, either when you're using the proceeds from your mortgage to pay off her debt, because you have to. You can only give $14,000 per year to an individual, and any individual, without having to file a gift tax return. That doesn't mean you'll incur the gift tax, but it means you have to file a return, and it's 709 and form 709. And if you have a CPA do your taxes here, she should point that out once you point out what you're doing here. The second thing I would do is be cautious about the interest rate that you charge her. The IRS says that when family members are lending money back and forth to each other specifically, they have to charge a minimum interest rate. It's very low, but if you don't either charge the right interest rate or collect the payments as they're coming due, sometimes that can be looked upon as a gift as well. But there's a document you can look at for this process, especially. Are you going to lend her the money technically or give?
I'm going to give her the money. I'm going to assume her debt, mm-hmm. and then she's going to pay back the difference on the mortgage debt. Would be her part of the debt that I would be incurred.
Great. You might want to draw up those documents for lots of different reasons and just have it on paper on what the original agreement is. And you should definitely talk to a lawyer and an accountant about this, but you can look at the getting the documents for yourself at a website called loanback.com, LOANBACK.com. And that allows you to drop the documents, calculate the interest charges, et cetera. And it's like $30. Again, I'd want you to bring a lawyer and a CPA into the conversation, especially at first, to make sure it's established appropriately. But at least when it comes to the documents, loanback.com, and we'll put that up at onyourmoney.com later on today.
Great, I appreciate it.
All right, thank you very much, Tom, for the call. And congratulations. I'm glad your daughter graduated.
Yeah, he sounds burdened by it, but there are thousands of parents out there going like, man, I would trade places with him in a heartbeat.
Yeah,
to have a daughter with an engineering degree, a job, and we'll take all the debt that comes with it.
Well, you know, it's time for smart assets, and it is related. The looming end of the school year means that thousands of families are going to be worrying about paying for college in a few months, but it can be complicated to withdraw money from a particular college savings vehicle. Why is that, Kevin?
And I like how you use the word vehicle, because we are talking a lot about cars today.
That's right.
It's the 529 college savings plans that we just referenced. And then again, one of the advantages of these plans is that the adult making the gift keeps control over the money. Typically, most of them have like a mutual fund lineup, kind of like you might have in your at-work retirement plan. And the earnings left in the plan are sheltered from taxation. And then with withdrawals are made from it, as long as the withdrawals are matched up for qualified higher education expenses, the withdrawals are tax-free as well.
So what do you mean by qualified?
It's pretty generous. The IRS determines what are qualified, but it's usually tuition and then room and board if the student is at least half-time enrolled, and the schools generally determine what number room and board can be used for qualified expenses. It can be fees and books as well, but generally it's a certain kind of school that has to be eligible to accept federal financial aid for their students. And again, the student generally has to be enrolled at least half-time. So although the Culinary Institute of America is a qualified institution, if you're just going for a weekend seminar on sous cooking, you probably can't use a qualified distribution from a 529 for that purpose.
So how are you supposed to report the withdrawals?
You first of all request a distribution from the account manager, the mutual fund company or whatever's running it, and then you have to match up expenses in the year incurred. You don't have to transfer the money from the 529 to the school. You just have to pay the expense, and then in the year in which the expenses are incurred, make that corresponding withdrawal from the 529. And then at the end of the year, the sponsor will send you a 1099-Q form, which will say, here was the money that was taken out, and here's how much of it was earnings, here's how much of it was non-taxable principal. And then you basically have to keep that on hand in case you're audited at some point down the road. The IRS might ask you, well, where were these expenses? Here's the 1099, and then here are receipts for the money that we paid in the matching year.
So what happens if I take out the money and I use it for a brand new car?
You don't get any more birthday cards from your nieces and nephews anymore.
Right.
It's a common issue. There's no deadline generally to pull the money out or mandatory distribution required usually. You can use it later if you want. You can transfer it to another child. But if you do, like you say, just need to take it out, you'll pay a tax and a penalty, but only on the earnings portion of the account. So let's say you put in $10,000 a long time ago. It's blossomed up to $15,000. There's $5,000 of earnings. So if you pull the whole thing out, your taxes and your penalty will still be maybe $2,000 to $3,000, but that's of the $15,000, and you probably would have paid the taxes on it anyway. And if you realize that you have a 529 account and you still have losses in it, meaning it's worth less than what you put in, there's no taxes or penalties at all to take it out.
I'm Joy Cardine with Kevin McKinley, and we'll get to more of your phone calls in just a moment at 1-800-642-1234. You can also send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. And coming up, we will have some tips on saving money at the gas pump. Our next caller is Marcus in Menasha. Hi, Marcus.
Money at...
Oops, Marcus, you're not listening on the phone, but to the radio. So we'll go to Tom in Oshkosh. Hi, Tom.
Hi. How are you today?
Good,
well,
Tom. Go ahead.
Okay. I've got two boys. Excuse my voice. My brother died and is leaving them some money, between $8,000 and $10,000, I figure. And one of the boys is in eighth grade, and the other is in sophomore. And I'm a firm believer in education, and I'm wondering what I should do with their monies until they need it. Any suggestions?
Sure. Well, they're going to need it probably sooner than we might expect, just because I know from having children of my own, they get old quickly. So so I'd probably try to keep it safe, not expect a whole lot of growth, if indeed you do planning on using it for their higher education expenses. Do either of the kids have a job, or are they planning on getting a job this summer?
Yes. The sophomore will probably be working.
Oh, great. One thing that can be have a really fantastic long-term effect on the sophomore's future is to use some of that money to deposit it into a Roth IRA that is equal to the amount that he or she earns in a given calendar year. Now, that's already his or her money. It's already been gifted to them through the will. So it has to stay in their name, and the Roth IRAs are okay with that. The Edvest accounts and things, it's difficult for you to keep your name on it if it's already technically become their money and gifted to them. So I would prefer that you use this either in an Edvest account for near-term expenses, a checking account for near-term expenses, or if you want something you're willing to go out a little longer, the Roth IRA matched up with earnings is a great deal, because you can always pull the contributions back out at any time for any reason with no taxes or penalties whatsoever. And because they're not going to make much money, they're not going to be in a very high income bracket, so putting it into a after-tax Roth IRA really doesn't hurt their tax situation at all. But that $5,000 put in for a kid this year could be worth $50,000 to $100,000 50 years from now when he or she needs it, and it will be all tax-free.
Thanks for the call, Tom, and good luck. I'm Joy Cardine with Kevin McKinley, Certified Financial Planner, Managing Member of McKinley Money, LLC. We'll have those gas pump saving tips coming up in just a moment, and more of your phone calls at 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. This is On Your Money on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
She's real fine, my 409. She's real fine, my 409, my 409.
Well, if that doesn't get you in the mood for summer and driving, the summer driving season kicks off and gas prices have already jumped. Kevin, doesn't this happen every year?
It's like clockwork. You know, winter ends and Memorial Day is just a few weeks away. And as that happens, so do prices rise on a gallon of gas. Recent figures nationwide, about $3.70. Wisconsin at $3.95. Historically, that price is 15 cents higher than a week ago, 30 cents higher than a month ago, and about 20 cents higher than a year ago. So even with the rise in prices a year ago at this time, we're still experiencing a higher price than we were 12 months ago.
So what's the reason behind the recent jump?
Nobody knows. Everybody has a different reason. And a lot of times when you're reading about it, you have to go back and consider the source, because there's always some political bent to why the gas prices are high, because everybody's complaining about it, but nobody does anything about it. Some people say it's speculators driving the price of oil up. Others say refinery capacity is affecting it. Others say demand is, because more people driving during the summer. And other people, of course, say the taxes and the regulation. It's expensive to produce to meet the emission quality, et cetera. Usually it's everybody along the line trying to do what everybody else does, which is get the most money they think they can get.
And why do I always wait until my gas is on E and then the spike has occurred and I have to fill up my tank at the most expensive? Anyway, is there any what tips do you have on how we might save money on gas?
Well, first of all, don't shop around by driving around. At the cost per mile, if you get 20 miles per gallon, which you probably don't if you're driving around where gas stations usually are, you're costing yourself about 20 cents a mile. And if you have a 15-gallon tank or so and you have to drive an extra mile and back, it can cost you the equivalent of 3 to 7 cents of savings in a gallon, depending on the mileage of your car, etc. And that doesn't even talk about the wear and tear on the car that you're putting on as well. So usually you're better off stopping where it's convenient, or just biting the bullet and paying what they're asking nearby.
Yes. other than drive less, how can we spend less on gas?
Get your vehicle tuned up so that you're using less gas to get where you need to go. Inflate the tires up to the proper level. I'm sure that's something that you haven't done in a long time. Mm-hmm. Take it into the shop and get a check. Make sure the fuel line is very clear. Watch your slow starts and stops. Definitely try to gradually accelerate and decelerate. And Joy, I'm sorry to admonish you for this, but you should not be driving on an empty tank, as tempting though as it may be, because there is sediment in every bit of gasoline, and the less gas you have, the sediment settles at the bottom of the tank, and the less gas you have in there, the more that the percentage of the makeup of what's in your tank is sediment, and it's more likely that it could get into the fuel line or down the road and clog things up and create much bigger problems. You're only delaying the inevitable. Just stop when you can, fill up the tank, you'll feel better about it.
Yeah, I wish I would have filled it up before gas prices spiked by 30 cents. But anyway, I thought you were going to admonish me for my lead foot.
I can hear you often at 9:02 coming right out of the WPR parking lot. If there's a squeal of tires and a spray of gravel, you know Joy's heading home.
Yeah. Anyway, so what about those gas station credit cards? Do they help save money on gas?
Probably not, unless you're a really heavy driver, drive, 30, 40,000 miles a year, and you have good credit. You're typically only going to save a few cents a gallon. So normal drivers might, spend money on 1,000 gallons per year. So if you save $50 in a year, that's great, but that might be the annual fee on the credit card. And if you don't pay it off on time, you're obviously going to compound that problem with interest on it. And it can have a slightly negative effect on your credit report if you add one more credit card on there that you're only using to save a few cents in gas.
I don't usually shop at a particular grocery store, but I do enough that I accrued gas money off a gallon of gas. That's the credit that this particular...
Yeah, I see that. They proudly hand that to you, and you've saved 2 cents a gallon at the pump for the $284 yes. You just spent with us.
But what was funny about it is that I didn't even remember that I had the card, and I pulled up to a gas station. It said, insert your, gas... grocery card here for, and I got 15 cents off per gallon. So that wasn't too shabby.
That's not too bad at all. That tends to add up. That makes a big difference. And it actually, price-wise anyway, transported you back to basically last week's prices.
That's
right. It's almost like a time machine.
I felt good about that. Well, if you have a question for Kevin, we have time for a few more calls at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@WPR.org. I'm sorry, send that email to onyourmoney@WPR.org. And our next caller is Greg in Milwaukee. Hi, Greg.
Hi. I have a car, a 2003 Element that's paid for, had some front-end damage that the insurance company has said it's totaled. So they've offered me a settlement that's about $2,000 more than an estimate that I got to repair the car at my own expense if I buy it from them as a total vehicle. I'm trying to get a handle on whether this is a wise financial decision to buy this car back and have it repaired. The damage did not affect the drivetrain, the suspension, or anything. It's just the front end and the radiators. So can you give me any guidance on this?
Boy, it's tempting to try to take the prudent, frugal way out, Greg, and go back in to get it. But I'm guessing even if everything goes well with it, you're going to end up with a car that's worth less than what you have into it. And you're really only delaying the inevitable, because even if you do go through all this work, you end up with a drivable car. The Element's a nice car, but how much longer are you going to keep it? And so I'd rather have you just say, thank you very much, move on, let's get a new car. New cars traditionally have been a sign of almost, like impetuousness or bad money decision. But the nice thing about a new car is several fold. First of all, if you get a loan, you get the best terms on a loan. Second of all, you get a warranty, so you know that your costs on it are capped, meaning that it's basically going to be either the payment of paying for the thing or your monthly payment. Very unlikely to have any surprises with it. And Greg, have you worked hard most of your life?
Not as hard as I'd like.
Okay. Well, have you ever had a new car before?
This was a new car. Yeah, it's paid for. It's got 136,000 miles on it. I know what's been put into it. You know, and they're not making them anymore.
Well, that's one issue. They don't make them like they used to, then that's just because they don't make them. I tell you, Greg, that you're probably better off just taking the check and going out looking for a new car and getting done with it rather than taking on the unpredictability of the next few years and then really just kicking the can down the road, as it were, because you're going to have to make this decision probably in a few years anyway. At least this way you get a new car to drive.
Yeah. Sorry about your car, Greg. Sam in Madison is with us. Hi, Sam.
Good morning, Joy, Kevin, long-time listener, first-time caller.
well, thanks for calling.
I apologize. My question is off-topic, but Kevin, I'm a U.S. permanent resident, but I'm a citizen of India. I recently went to see my family, and we started talking about finances, and they said that, look, in the U.S., the interest rates are so low right now, it might be a good idea for you to invest some money here. For example, even if you were to put some money in the bank here, the interest rate could be as high as 10%. Besides that, they said you can buy some property here. The prices of property almost double every 5 years, and you can actually, this could be a better investment option. My question to you, Kevin, is that is it a smart idea to take money out of here, invest it over there, and you make some money, but when you bring it back, do you pay so much in taxes on maybe some other fees that it's almost not worth considering that option?
Well, first of all, Sam, great question, and you don't have to apologize for going off topic. Most of my answers are actually off topic as well, too, so no apologies necessary there. I like the question and I like the thought, but there's a reason that other countries are paying a higher rate of interest on, so let's say, their government bonds than the United States is, because that investors who control trillions of dollars worldwide are concerned about those countries or investments being able to pay off at the rate that the United States will be able to do it. So there's a reason for that higher rate of return. But you know more about it, obviously, than most people globally would. So I'm okay with that. In terms of moving the money back and forth, that's where it gets tricky, because most of the times when I move money back and forth across country lines, I'm smuggling it in suitcases and toothpaste tubes. So I can't tell you that it's either a good idea or even what you would have to do to declare that. And people the regulators take a very dim view of trying to move money back and forth across international boundaries, and it can be very difficult to do. So if you said you're just going to leave the money there in the country and maybe use it in the future or help a relative out or whatever, I might be okay with it. But keep in mind that the reason that the rates are high is because the risk is as well.
Okay, Sam?
Thanks, Kevin.
Yeah. Thanks for calling, and call early, call often.
I'm still waiting for the long-time caller, first-time listener.
Yeah, that's good. To show up. I think that happens a lot. What do you mean? Michael in Hortonville is with us now. Hi, Michael.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
You bet.
This is a question about mortgage. We recently sold a house in Wisconsin, and we purchased a house in Colorado. And that house, the mortgage, the lender in Colorado is wanting us to possibly reduce the number of years that we have on the loan, which I like to do that. We paid off our house faster rate here in Wisconsin, and we were pretty diligent about making one or two payments extra a year, so it reduced the number of years of our loan. Now, I want to do that in Colorado, but the current lender has a new program that says, okay, if you want to do that, we'll do bi-monthly or whatever you want to do, but it'll be $238 for initiation of that program, and then we're going to charge you $2.13, I think it is, every time you make a payment. And then you'll reduce your years of a 30-year mortgage down to 20 or even 15 if you can pay it off that fast. My question is, and I think I know my own answer, but I want to hear what you say about that, is should I buy into their program where they're going to charge me this fee, or should I go out of their program, find a different lender, because they won't let me do it on my own? I said, look, I can make two payments a month. And they said, no, we you do that on your own. You have to either buy into our program or you make one payment every first of the month.
Well, what about your stinkers? So, why do they do that, Kevin?
Well, because interest rates are nothing, and therefore banks are having a hard time making money and profits, and therefore they have to come up with new creative ways to make money. This is one of them, and I would tell you a couple of things. First of all, I would still get the 30-year mortgage, and I would get it from someplace else, and I would not participate in this program that I'm sure they can justify and say, well, it's fees, processing, blah, blah, blah. But I would get a 30-year mortgage and then make the payment that, let's say, the 15-year required. And what will happen is if you do that, you'll still pay the mortgage off in probably about 15 and a half years, depending on the interest rate spread between the two mortgages. But at any given moment, you can slow it down and say, whoa, I need this money for something else, or interest rates have gone up, so I don't feel like paying the debt off. I'd rather invest the difference. But yeah, get the 30-year, get it at a different institution, and I would not participate in their program.
Thanks for the call, Michael. Dave in Milwaukee is with us now. Hi, Dave.
Hi, good morning.
Yes, go ahead.
My question has to do with basically potential tax implications of a 401k rollover. Fun subject.
Yep.
So I've been making Roth contributions to my employer's 401k, of course, matched by them with pre-tax dollars. And after crunching some numbers with your, you know, off-quoted recommendation on the program to attempt to get below that 15% federal threshold, I think it's $35,000 and some change.
For single filers? Mm-hmm. It's $36,250 on line 43 of the 1040.
There we go. That's the one. So to do that, you know, I was toying with the idea of instead making traditional contributions, but then I would end up with the situation of having a 401k with both a Roth component and traditional. And to me, that's not a particularly elegant solution because, you know, if I rolled over in the future, I kind of have this weird account that has, you know, both pre-tax and post-tax dollars, and that might implicate, you know, a big tax bill or something like that. So my question is, you know, should I go that route and kind of keep the pooled money, maybe open a traditional IRA or something like that?
Well, as a fellow American, Dave, I appreciate your patriotism and spending more money on taxes than you've had to. We need every dollar we can get, so thank you. However, I would go with your original thought of saying I'm going to switch over to a pre-tax plan and not worry about the co-mingling, because if and when it comes time to roll over, there'll be paperwork in place at the new custodian, if you will, who can separate out the Roth from the traditional one. You will not be taxed on all the Roth. It won't be combined. Just don't combine it, obviously. But yes, you could. There's a conduit that you can use to slide the Roth portion over into a Roth IRA for yourself and the pre-tax 401k into a traditional IRA or even another employer's 401k if you decide to do that. But yeah, as you've heard, because you've been patient and strong enough to actually listen to the show, I'm not a huge fan of Roth 401ks for most people.
Thanks, Dave. Good luck to you. Kevin, after a caller to a recent show asked about finding places to get information and education in the Fox River Valley area, we received a helpful email with regards to that. What did it say?
Well, Kathy from Appleton said you can get classes at the tech school, and that was a great solution. We'll have a link up to the classes that she put at onyourmoney.com. I attended 3-night classes on investing when I was in high school. You can also go to moneysmartwi.gov to find classes in your area. And then there are also the Khan Academy, the MOOC, massively open online course, has several courses online that you can watch for free at khanacademy.org. And again, we'll have all those links up at onyourmoney.com. Later on today.
All right. Well, we have time now for the website of the week.
GasBuddy.com can help you find lowest gas prices in your area without having to drive to look at it. You can get an app on your phone that can notify you if you're near low gas prices. GasBuddy.com, and we'll put that up at OnYourMoney.com later on today.
And finally, four more words before we go.
Spend less, have more.
Kevin McKinley is a certified financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money, LLC. He's going to be off next Tuesday, the Tuesday after Memorial Day. We're going to allow him one vacation day, and then he'll be back the week after that. We'll have another On Your Money-related program, though, for you next week at this time with a different guest. Thanks to Bill Martins and to Christy Taylor for producing and directing this program. Thank you for listening. I hope you stay tuned. There's much more to come. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.